You can't start the car. Johnny has the keys.
Hello, hello, hello out there in podcast land and YouTube land. You have reached Johnny Has the Keys, where we talk about horror movies and science fiction films and those key elements that lift them above the average genre fare. Are you joining us for the first time? Well, we would like you to welcome you to the party. Come hang out with the cool kids. You know you want to, Opie. Are you rejoining us? Well, we'd like to welcome you back because you'll get why I'm always stumbling on my words and have terrible introductions. I am here with my good friend, Mr. David Horton. He's my co-host. David, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. I love your intros. It's always so impromptu. But that's kind of, you know, as we've said several times, that's kind of like what I like about doing the show with you. Is we don't script this out, and this is just us talking and what comes to mind, and sometimes we'll overlap. So I like that.
Sometimes we may even use the word
No, never. There is never an or an or a yeah sort of thing. I've been good genre wise.
Oh yeah, what's going on your genre week?
Well, I've been doing a lot of homework for upcoming shows, of course, and trying to stay on top of all that. But for an indulgence, I guess, because I think I even mentioned either last week or week before, whatever, I finally finished Strange New Worlds, which is the new Star Trek. But it just kind of put me in my Star Trek mode. And, you know, on the sister podcast, we're doing original series, season two. But it just kind of inspired me. So I went back and I revisited Wrath of Khan. We've covered it in the show. Loved the movie. I could watch it every month.
Yeah, me too.
And just went back again and just marveled at what a great, we're doing our top five too. By the way, if you're on YouTube and want to see our top five, those are coming out now too. You know, we had to clump in the thing. We had to clump everything together in production. You know, We had to say, oh, is this and this. And that's the way.
Our 5-minute video was 12 minutes.
Well, that's the way Wrath of Khan is for me. It's just everything. I even like, you know, Shatner's toupee in it. I love the movie, everything about it, the lighting, the direction, the what they call the monster maroon, which is that, you know, that red uniform, one of my favorite uniforms in Star Trek history.
It's definitely more formal military.
And there was a great thing about understanding that Star Trek came from a, you know, it was created by military men, essentially, with Roddenberry and Kuhn and Justman and all the rest of them, who all had service records. And they kind of infused that in the original writing. And, you know, that's kind of carried through in Wrath of Khan, that whole military bearing. And it's just a well-done movie. Anyway, I just revisited it. I loved it. I liked it. I'm sure it's not a foreign horror movie from Shudder or anything. So.
Wow. Should you mention movies from Shudder?
What? Me? Never.
I did not watch a foreign movie from Shudder. However, I did watch a movie. I gauged some of these and picked some of these because I look at the ratings on Rotten Tomatoes just because I don't want to get a real turkey. In this case, I got a little fooled. This one was called The Taking of Deborah Logan. And it looks,
okay,
when you see the poster, obviously, it looks like a possession story of some sort.
Well, it says evil lives within you. So I'm just saying, kind of.
Well, what I didn't know is that it's a found footage movie. And I started watching it and almost stopped because, you know, I'm not a fan of found footage movies. They need to be really good if they're going to hold my attention. The problem... It's a shame because the story is, it starts off really well. Basically, it's about a woman that has going through Alzheimer's. So her daughter hires, she's going to lose her house. She has no money. So her daughter hires a documentary crew from like a local school to do a documentary that will get them funding so that she can keep her house or whatever. And it turns out, obviously, that she's not got Alzheimer's. She's possessed. But so the creepiness in that alone to me is a good plot or origin. I mean, that's a good way to go. It just gets, it goes off into left field with all of a sudden tying in the possession being that of a serial killer that got killed and I guess did some kind of Indian ritual, and her daughter, there's a lot of coincidence here, her daughter was going to be the fifth victim of this serial killer, and now he is coming back through her mother, not Alzheimer's, and is going to get his fifth victim, because there's this fifth victim he has to have to create, I don't know, some pentagram.
The portal into the evil world. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. It got 91% on Rotten Tomatoes. I would have given it at least 75 or 80 probably. It's directed by a guy named Adam Robitaille. He doesn't have a lot. I looked at his resume, a lot of video shorts of escape room things. Not so this was like his first delve into a feature film, which this went direct to video. I think you could buy it for download at first, and then now, of course, you can stream it. It was written by Robitaille and a guy named Gavin Heffernan. He's not got a lot of credits as well. Mm-hmm. However, they did cop a woman named Jill Larson to play Deborah, and she is a soap opera vet. She's been on All My Children since like 1989. Okay. And she's great. I mean, she is awesome, and she is insanely skinny. I mean, she looks creepy almost as herself because she is very, very skinny. And then the only woman I recognized is Anne Ramsey, who plays her daughter, Sarah. And she's just a character actress. I didn't know her from anything. I had to look her up. She was in A League of Their Own. She was actually in the Tim Burton version of Planet of the Apes. And okay. She was on Mad About You. So she's done a lot of work. So they got some good actors to be in it. But the problem is, once you start realizing that she's possessed and connected to the serial killer, it just starts spiraling. And to get scary, they start moving the camera and running around and jumping a lot, which is the thing I hate the most. I mean, I would mm-hmm. tolerate the screenplay before I'll tolerate that.
Right.
And there's some weird special effects. At one point, she lowers her jaw like a snake and tries to swallow a girl's head. I think I've got a picture of that in there. But I don't want to give away too many spoilers other than it was a noble effort, but I would not watch it again, and I probably would not recommend it for our show at all. So,
well, neither one of us is a fond of fan of found footage, and most of that is due to the fact of that lack of cinematography skill to it. I see it a lot now in television, especially this whole, we can never keep the camera still on a shot. Even if we're on a shot, we're just slowly kind of waving or we're moving like this, even if in a, and instead of a nice pan or a nice zoom or anything, it's this constant kind of fluid. And I'm going, it annoys the hell out of me. I'm going, why are they doing this when it could just be, you know, they do it all. They even did it in one episode of Strange New Worlds that I recently watched, and I was going, why are you doing that in this scene?
It makes no sense. We covered Hunger Games last season, they did it in the beginning of Hunger Games. I'm like, why are they doing this?
That whole opening of just, yeah, we can't just look at something, you know, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But
do you think it's because of, and I don't mean to segue too long, but do you think it's a marriage of reality TV and film?
Sort of, yeah, but a reality TV to me is a lot tighter and more intercut.
Yeah, you know what? You're right. It is.
Than that. I think it comes from this aesthetic sense of it's adding realism because it looks like it's handheld by a phone. It looks like we're really there, like you would see it through your phone kind of thing. And that, or that mentality. That's my assumption about it. It's an aesthetic I don't like at
all. Well, we're brought up on true cinema, and true cinema, it wants you to forget that there's somebody behind the camera and that you're in the story.
Right.
They're reminding you that somebody's behind the camera.
Correct. And anytime they even do it in a little, you know, in a shot like that, it pulls me out of the scene. I immediately go, why are you doing that? Anyway.
Oh, well.
We are in science fiction world. We're in post-apocalyptic world, a favorite genre, subgenre for Tim and I. Mm-hmm. We are doing a 1975 film called A Boy and His Dog. If you have not seen this movie, go watch it right now before you get into our podcast, because we do spoil the bejesus out of stuff. Definitely for this, we will. And this has some surprises and some unique stuff to it that you don't want to spoil if you've never experienced L.Q. Jones's adaptation of Harlan Ellison. And that's basically the credits for it. It is written and directed by a gentleman named L.Q. Jones, who was an actor. He actually was a Peckinpah actor. And this is really the only big thing he ever did. He adapted a short story slash novella by Harlan Ellison, the famous science fiction writer, called The Beast That Shouted Love at the Heart of the World, and turned it into A Boy and His Dog. You had obviously seen this movie before. I have obviously seen this movie before. Before I do the synopsis, what did you think on the rewatch? Did you?
Well, I was trying to remember the first time I saw it, and I'm pretty sure I saw it at Dee and Rodney's house that we rented it on video.
Okay.
And I was not a huge fan of it then, and I'm still kind of not a huge fan of it.
Okay.
It's, to me, it looks, especially the stuff that's above ground, looks like a bunch of guys said, hey, let's make a movie in the desert.
Yeah.
And I have a key later on that there is one really good thing that came out of this movie. But I kind of agree with Harlan in that a lot of people love this movie for its last line, and Harlan doesn't, because it's basically just turns the movie into a joke with a punchline. Does that make sense?
Sort of, yeah. I would disagree in that it's not like they haven't set up that the dog does have these kind of humorous attitude and humorous mm-hmm. quips and lines and everything else all the way through it. So it's not like that's a huge surprise mm-hmm. that he makes a pun at the end. And I like the pun, actually. I was amazed rewatching in the end, because I haven't watched this in a decade probably or more. I was surprised at how much I remembered and how much I was influenced by it. It brought back a flood of memories from the Theater Guild days and everything else, of me even using the line once more into the breach. I use that a lot. The whole pun ending, it was just a huge influence on me. This was a unique movie. I think I owned it on VHS. I had it. I watched it a lot, quite a few times. I liked the post-apocalyptic setting. I liked the whole, you know, at first I was going, why are they digging down in these craters? I don't understand. And then I realized, oh, because there's like 20 feet of dirt on top of the world sort of thing. And they're actually going through skylights and roofs and everything else, which I thought was a cool concept I had not seen before. A brief synopsis. It's set, of course, in a post-apocalyptic world. A boy named Vic is able to communicate telepathically with his dog named Blood, and they scavenge for food, they scavenge for shelter, and they scavenge for sex because he's a young boy. They stumble or get actually trapped into an underground society that is preserving the old way. It's a Topeka, I think. Because the daughter of one of the leaders of the community seduces him, lures him down. He ends up finding out that he's going to become a breeder, an impregnator for the women of this underground society, because it seems the men have become impotent due to, lack of sunlight or something. They kind of just briefly hint at it. And so every few years, they have to bring somebody from the surface down and use their sperm for their women to make more children's. And he naturally escapes from that. And then there's a humorous kind of tag ending to it. You weren't a fan. Were there any scenes that you did like in it? No.
I have a lot of questions. I want to know why everyone down below wears white face makeup like clowns with Shields and Yarnell-esque.
I think that was a very 70s affectation to show that they are fake, that they're insincere, that they're wearing a, quote, mask.
Okay.
Kind of
thing.
Well,
and I get the impression that LQ may be a hippie, kind of.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I got that impression, too, from a lot of the stuff. I mean, I had that, too, at first, but it also throws you off. It definitely makes you, as a viewer, go, what is going on? Almost that mid-70s, late 60s sort of hippie feel of you know, when they would show parties in the 60s, they were these weird mixes of, like, strange camera angles or shooting through the wine glass or weird lava lamp lights on the walls. And it was all this trippy, weird, strange stuff. And then when they would project future society, they would do the same thing. Rollerball did the same thing. The future society was this weird mix of partying and weirdness.
Well, I mean, it's the time. It's when they filmed them. I mean, they were both filmed in the mid-70s. So.
Right. And they do the same kind of thing here. I think it's to intentionally throw you off. I have not read the source material.
Well, I was going to correct you on that, actually. The collection is called The Beast That Shouted Love at the Heart of the World. The story is A Boy and His Dog, because The Beast is actually a story itself.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So, yes, I'm familiar with the actual source material. So, I'm curious if Harlan described them that way.
I've actually never read the short story. I have read The Beast story, but I've not read A Boy and His Dog. Harlan was kind of a victim of his time, too. We have talked about him a lot on our sister podcast, The Dilithium Chamber, because he wrote one of the most famous episodes of Star Trek. But we also know that he was a little horn dog, always trying to get into different women cast member pants at the time. And that's what cracks me up about this story. This story kind of makes me feel adolescent Harlan, where it's all about getting laid and eating food. Basically, that's this movie is about. You know, all Don Johnson is a horn dog, you know, running around trying to get laid in the apocalypse.
Yes. Yes, I totally agree with that. He's definitely not a Mad Max. He's not a hero. He's not anything like that. He is simply a survivor and very adolescent.
And very obnoxious, yeah.
Maybe that's why it appealed to me because, I mean, at the time, I mean, I was a 14-year-old boy. Right. I kind of liked this movie. It had a lot of things I agreed with at the time sort of thing.
I could understand a young heterosexual man really appreciating the story for those things alone, especially, you know, adolescent. But as a gay man, it didn't reach out to me that way at all. So,
well, and now we look at it as very misogynistic.
I would say so, very much so.
Even though she is portrayed really well in this. The cast, like you said, the cast has Don Johnson in the role of Vic. It has Jason Robards as essentially the villain, the head of the committee down below. And Suzanne Benton as the girl in it. And she's actually really strong in this. Mm-hmm. I liked her portrayal. I was surprised when I did research that she hadn't done more. She didn't go on to do a lot more stuff because I expected her to have done it. But you know, then I didn't recognize her and I was going, I don't remember. So she did a lot of television, but not a lot by any means compared to other, you know, actors and actresses that we have covered.
No, before. I don't have any notes in her, for her as far as casting.
Yeah. And she just didn't go anywhere, but neither did the director. Neither did L.Q. Jones. And I thought he should have. I thought he did an adequate job in directing this and creating the different scenes and some of the way he did his structure of cinematography. This took 5.5 years to make. So to your point of, hey, let's go film a movie in the desert.
I'm shocked.
Maybe that's probably why.
Oh, because they were just doing it on weekends, like as a party?
Okay, yeah. Maybe we could just do it on the weekends. Are you stoned this week? No, I'm pretty good, man. Okay, cool. Let's go film.
Well, and that would also explain why Don Johnson looks like he's almost 30 and he's playing a boy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely true.
I think I looked. I think he was 26, maybe.
You talked about scenes. I really liked... I remember scenes in this. I remember the movie scene, of course, because it's, you know, bad porno and racist movies. That's their entertainment, really.
And L.Q. Jones is actually the star of one of those porno movies.
That's what I read. I don't... I'm assuming it's the one that actually has a title, although I didn't write the title
down.
Well,
I don't think it was real, but I think he played the actor in the movie or whatever.
Right, yeah. That's what I mean. But yeah, the one that had a little bit more notice. Not the one where they're talking about burning the person in the church or whatever. That was just so almost offensive.
almost.
but I remember that scene. I remember the scene, of course, in the boiler room and the once more into the breach, my friend, and, you know, I remember the screamers, because I thought that was a cool concept of radiated mutants that you're afraid of. Mm-hmm. And that's a very sci-fi concept.
Same people.
So, yeah. that was my key there. Sorry. You had that. That's okay. And then I remember Michael, the overall straw hat, red gingham check shirt robot.
Yeah.
That is the enforcer.
I would say his scenes are the ones that stick out to me the most, especially when he's coming after them.
Well, naturally, that's the horror part. He's going and tearing people's heads off and stuff. Yeah, of course you like that part. You know?
Like, yeah. I also remember this is kind of boring. Oh, wow. He tore his head off.
He tore his head off. Cool. And of course, I like blood all the way through this. I love the voice actor who plays him, and I think he has such personality. Blood has – the dog character has such personality. And I remember at one point doing research on this, I was reading it, and at one point in the iteration of the script, they were going to animate Blood's mouth so that he talked.
Like they – but that technology was not available yet, like Jurassic Park.
Nor would it have worked or been anywhere near good.
I mean, even the first films that did that in the 90s didn't look good. Like Look Who's Talking and whatever the pet movies were.
Right. Well, but the point is that it wouldn't have worked because of the whole concept of the telepathy. That's what made it really cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I could see that. Dennis was in the room when I started watching it, and he immediately went, "I know that voice. Who is that?" And I was like, "Well, I don't think you know it, but it is very familiar sounding." He thought it was a famous actor instead of the character actor that it is. What is his name? Tim McIntyre played the dog.
But he recognized the voice. Well, I like the voice because it does remind you of, you know, somebody's grandfather, mm-hmm. or some, you know, it's a very soothing voice. I like his meter. I love his inflections. I thought he was really, I thought that was really good. I also thought the casting of Jason Robards as the villain and the way he played it was creepy as hell mm-hmm. to me.
I think he's the strongest, obviously, in this.
Oh, mm-hmm. yeah, by far. And, you know, those line readings of lack of respect, wrong attitude, failure to obey authority to the farm. Mm-hmm. You know, the farm immediately.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was just, oh my gosh. It was, and it had a very Ellison timbre to it, Ellison kind of language. Mm-hmm. All of the stuff underneath reminded me more of Ellison than the stuff on top, if that makes mm-hmm. sense. I would also, and thinking of watching it again this time, I meant to look it up and see if there is. And so if even you out there can find it and source it, send it to us. But I wonder if there's a recording somewhere of just the stuff on the broadcasts, just the stuff that's being, said over the speaker mm-hmm. in Topeka, because you kept hearing this, Amber Alert, the hydroponics garden, Amber Alert, you know, and then, and this huge chase is going on and you're hearing, you know, something like, you know, make sure you only use blue cheese. A note from the committee. You know, I would love to know what they were really saying because you couldn't understand a lot of it.
Yeah. I don't – there's things I like and dislike almost simultaneously about this movie. One is that they – it's obviously filmed on the cheap, so there's not a lot of realism. And I would usually appreciate that in a film, but it's almost – too badly in this film. Like the desert scenes don't look apocalyptic enough, and the scenes below where it's supposed to be more normal look fake to me. I don't know if I'm articulating that the way I meant to, but it's almost the opposite, where I need a little more up top and a little less down below. Wow, that sounds like something you would say.
That's what she said. Although I don't share the observation, I can understand that. No, I don't think they had a lot of production value on the surface. And they basically, you know, although I did read that they brought in like 500 pounds of junk and garbage to throw everywhere for these scenes. And I don't think they have enough of an aesthetic of the apocalypse. It was filmed outside of Barstow, California. So it was filmed in a place that they could drive to in 20
minutes.
While
they're tripping on acid or whatever. Yeah.
Maybe. Yeah. I do think it, and we'll get to it in Keys, I do think it had a tremendous influence on later post-apocalyptic movies.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
It's interesting that you thought the scenes down below were fake because those were actually filmed on location as well.
I think a lot of it has to do with the makeup.
I think it's the makeup and the lighting. It's yeah. It's always dark down there, and it's intentionally very forced kind of weird lighting. It's from the side a lot of side lighting. And although I do love the fact that the bulk of it takes place in like a church. You know, that's their office. Mm-hmm. It's like a Methodist church somewhere. So that had a lot of Ellison to me, too. I agree with you. This is a kind of love it or hate it, or yes, it has some good stuff, but also some really bad stuff kind of movie mm-hmm. that, you know, similar to the ones we covered in the past. Although I tend to, in those, a lot of times go more toward the negative. I tend to go toward the positive in this one. I kind of like elements of this. And again, maybe it's because I was attracted to it when I was 14. Yeah. I've watched it several times since then. I love some of the language in it. I like. Even the misogynist lines in it, there's one where it sets up Vic. It sets up his character, although it's horrible, horrible in today's world. But he goes, man, why'd they have to cut her? She could have been used two or three more times.
I know. I was like, ooh, that line will not fly these days.
I cannot believe they got away with that. Right. But then you have other ones, like I said, the Jason Robards lines, or I guess it's kind of like you said, it feels like it was filmed on the weekends, or it's filmed like, hey, let's go make a movie in the desert. So a lot of it too is an undying respect for Mr. Rowe and his stuff, because there's so many scenes, especially on the surface, where I was going, I wonder how much fun they had audio dubbing this. Because You're watching Vic and Blood, and they're watching the scavengers kind of go underground in this one location. And he's thinking about running up and stealing the food from the scavengers. But you're hearing this running dialogue of all these guys in the
pit. Just saying random shit.
And the guy yelling, just saying, right. You better see any shoes? I need some shoes. Yeah. Find some shoes for me.
It reminded me, of like us with Rowe. By the way, y'all out there that don't know who Rowe is, he's an old friend of ours, and he's an audio engineer. I guess you'd call him. Yeah, he's an audio engineer.
Yeah.
And we used to just dub, you know, homemade movies and stuff and put the craziest stuff in there. Especially when it was like a mouth was hidden, so you couldn't see that it wasn't going to match. He would say the craziest shit.
What they call now ADR, you know, which is looping over, and you're kind of rewriting the script as you go because nobody's seeing the mouth move, so I can put a line in here, you know, kind of thing. And Rowe loved that. But I've got other stuff too. I loved a very Ellison line to me was Vic, when he's leaving and she's saying, stay with me here, we'll rule underground and all that. And he said, no, I got to get back in the dirt so I feel clean again.
That's a good line. That's a real good line.
It's a really good character line. So there are moments.
I would say Ellison's story and Jason Robards are the strongest things about this. It was the execution, I think, I have more problems with.
Yeah.
I can talk a little bit about cast and awards before we move on into – I may even have a little trivia. I don't have a lot on cast. Obviously, Don Johnson was the lead. I didn't look. Did he do anything before this? Maybe something small?
Something small. Okay. I remember researching it.
Well, I mean, he went on 4 years later to play – or maybe it was 6 years later to play Sonny Crockett on Miami Vice, which is what made him famous. Yeah. And then, of course, he was married to Melanie Griffith, and they had Dakota Johnson, who is now a star herself. She was in the 50 Shades of Grey movie.
He has 9 credits prior to this, all television one-offs.
Okay. There you go.
So he was in, you know, Young Dr. Kildare and Kung Fu, the
so
series.
So he was Richard Chamberlain's replacement? I don't know. I think, wasn't Richard Chamberlain Kildare?
Okay, yeah.
I think he was.
I think so.
And then you mentioned Susan Benton, who was good in this. I just don't know her from anything else.
No, I didn't either.
Jason Robards is just a class act. I mean, he really didn't do horror movies or science fiction, yet here he is. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can't recall any horror movies he was ever in. Can you?
Pseudo horror, pseudo science fiction. He was cast in Something Wicked This Way Comes.
Oh, and that's right. He was.
When
he
I was like watching it, was a,
wasn't he?
Well, he's the narrator, essentially, who was the dad in it. And it's interesting because watching it, especially in his scenes underground, I was thinking, okay, this is the dad in Ray Bradbury's Something Wicked This Way Comes nightmare. This is his – we're living in his nightmare of what it would be like. That was a weird kind of twist.
Well, and Bradbury and Harl Nelson were loosely connected as far as that L.A. writing circle at the same time. Yep. So that's really kind of cool that he only did movies from those writers. we know him, of course, from The Wild Bunch and The Dirty Dozen. And apparently – it says he was originally slated to – oh, no, excuse me. I am totally wrong. I read that wrong. What I meant to say was that Robert Ryan was originally slated to play this role, and we know him from The Wild Bunch and The Dirty Dozen, not Jason Robards. Jason Robards was too clean for
that. That makes sense because the director came from The Wild Bunch.
Right.
Came from Sam Peckinpah.
Right. Yeah. Sorry, I totally walked over that one. We mentioned Tim McIntyre, who played Blood, the voice of the dog.
Blood.
And originally, they did want to get a more famous voice for the dog, and they decided against it. Did you know that?
No.
So you don't know who they originally wanted for the voice, which I think's hilarious.
No. Who?
James Cagney.
Oh, yes, I had read that. And I realized, and I totally agreed with their feeling beyond about it, which was he would totally upstage the whole thing.
Well, his name alone would upstage the movie, they felt. You know, I love Jimmy Cagney, and you don't see enough of him. But I don't know how it would have been had he played it. And then, of course.
You get the girl, see? Get the girl, see?
That's Deborah G. Robinson.
Same thing.
If it was maybe Blood would smash a grapefruit in. What's his name's face? Don Johnson.
Yeah.
And then Dr. Moore, Jason Robards' sidekick, Craddock's sidekick, is played by Alvy Moore. And Alvy Moore was.
He's on Green Acres, right?
Yeah, he was Hank Kimball on Green Acres.
Hank Kimball. Yep.
So they ended up, if it was filmed on a low budget on weekends, they still scored some cast members, especially Jason Robards. It makes me think maybe they filmed a lot of the weekend stuff out in the desert and they had Robards for one weekend and filmed all his scenes at once. I don't know.
Well, the one I thought was interesting, and I was looking it up in casting, was Hal Baylor. He played Michael. He was the Michael character who was – we meet underground. At first, we think, oh, he's just – you know, he's the muscle. He's the big guy who's kind of escorting Vic around and, you know, making sure he doesn't get into trouble and kind of the protector for the committee. But then near the end, we find out after he shot repetitive times that he's a robot.
He's a robot, yeah.
Because Robards, again, has one of those great lines. He goes, oh, yeah, and let's get another Michael out of the warehouse.
Them away. They're really great throwaway
lines.
Yeah,
they're awesome. Yeah. But Baylor, the guy that played him, has almost 200 credits on IMDb. He was in dozens and dozens and dozens of movies and television and everything. Huge history. I was going, my gosh, there are – there are several other people that do not have anywhere near that number of movies.
Was he a stuntman?
No, he was an actor. But he's always playing, you know, those little B characters. I mean,
usually
in the
when
background.
You see big guys like that are actors, they were former stuntmen.
Yeah, I never saw him as a former stuntman. Okay. He's just listed in IMDb as as an actor and known as an actor. Mm. But, I mean, he was in everything. I mean, he was in Evel Knievel and Bonanza and The Virginian. And, yeah, he's always, you know, he's never a lead as far as what I was doing.
Clancy studio players.
Yeah.
This movie did not win any awards. Actually, what? I take that back. It did win one award. It won some lesser prestigious ones. Our friends over at the Academy of Science Fiction, Fantasy, and Horror Films in 1976 gave Don Johnson Best Actor. Wow. That's why I kind of laugh at it.
Yeah, I wouldn't have gone there. No.
And it was nominated for Best Science Fiction Film. However, it didn't win. It did win a Hugo Award for Best Dramatic Presentation, and that went to L.Q. Jones and Wayne Creston Turner for the screenplay and Harlan Ellison for the story. Now, I see why that happened. I think that went because Harlan's name was on it, but...
Yeah, I can understand that.
Actually, it was nominated for the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America. I don't think we've ever covered them for Best Dramatic Writing, but no, it was not a winner there either, and it was not on our 1001 Movies You Must See Before You Die list either. So,
see, I would probably, as apocalyptic genre, subgenre, I would list it pretty high up there. In that subgenre. And, the movie will probably always be known for the last line.
Right.
Those of you, hopefully you've seen it, but if you haven't or want to know, here's the spoiler, that Vic does escape with Sally June? Quilla. Does escape with Quilla June, but they find blood near dead. He needs food. He's almost dead, everything else. And then we suddenly cut, and it's the next day or the next morning, and Blood is feeling much better, and obviously he was fed, and it's just Vic and Blood, and you're kind of looking in the background, you're seeing pieces of white costume, which is what Quilla June was wearing, and Blood is saying, you might need to save some of the meat for later, sort of thing, and the last line is Blood saying, I'd certainly say she had marvelous judgment, if not particularly good taste.
Yeah.
And he laughs as he delivers it. So he knows the pun he is saying. I always remembered it.
I think that's why this movie resonates with people. I think it's such a powerful coda that that's what people remember this movie fondly for. For one, sure, that when I watched this movie with Dee and Rodney, Dee was already saying, I love this movie. It has the best ending. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I'm sure.
So I was anticipating it being more, but to go through the whole movie to get to that, it's just a little bit of a letdown to me.
Well, I also think being known for that, it's another one of those like Planet of the Apes ending kind of things where you totally did not expect it. You did. I mean, his whole point was now he's been chasing women for the entire movie. Now he's got one.
Mm-hmm. And he sacrifices her for the dog.
Yeah. So it's an ending that you wouldn't see probably recreated and you didn't expect coming.
No. That was a good key, though, Planet of the Apes. I didn't even consider that because it had a twist ending, too, and this has a twist ending.
Yeah.
Apocalyptic twist ending. Both of them are sci-fi apocalyptic films.
The only trivia piece I found that I found interesting was this movie played nonstop for 14 years. Thanks to drive-in movies and midnight shows, it was always released from 75 to 89.
Wow.
And I thought that was very interesting. It played for 14 years in the midnight circuit and everything.
I mean, I would like to see a list of movies that did that because, I'm sure Rocky Horror is probably number one.
Same year. Rocky came out in 75, too.
And then what else would be up in there? Monty Python and the Holy Grail.
Maybe Holy Grail. Maybe
Dawn of the Dead.
dawn or night.
Yeah.
You know, when night was revived, I think it kind of played along a lot. But yeah, that would be a cool list to kind of research and see.
That's a topic in itself, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. So what about keys for you? I mean, there's one huge obvious I know you're going to do.
Are you talking about what it went on to inspire?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's another, if we were doing crystals, I would say that would be a crystal of this episode, is that it inspired George Miller to do Mad Max.
Oh, gosh.
And so I love this movie alone for giving me that series of movies. You know, that's
true.
Huge.
True.
And the thing, and I was going to allude to it earlier, and I didn't want to spoil the key, but it's clear that Miller went for the same aesthetic of a trashy-looking apocalyptic wasteland, but his just looks so much more cooler. It doesn't look like just a bunch of garage sale items thrown on a cart, you know?
True, true. His aesthetic was very much cobbled together kind of technology as opposed to just having what we have. Mm-hmm. Kind of thing. I could see it happening simultaneous in his universe only a few years earlier. So at the same time Mad Max was taking place, in other words, society is still there, so to speak. The cops are still the cops, all of that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Before it became Road Warrior would be Boy and His Dog. You know what I mean? So it's that transitional period when they haven't built their own cars into weird mechanizations or whatever. They're still just dealing with what they have left over, mm-hmm. kind of thing. I could see that. And the focus, you know, of course, in Miller was design and cars as opposed to women and weirdness.
Well, there is some misogynistic stuff in Mad Max, but it's the bad guys doing it. In this, it's technically the good guy doing it.
It's essentially well, and all the way through, even if you consider it, the committee down under considers women as secondary citizens. Yeah. There, even though there's a female on the committee, she's that old secretary that you always see in some, you know, rural community.
They're all sitting around hopped up, ready to get pregnant.
Oh, yeah. All the women are ready to get married and pregnant. That's what they should be. I'm talking about recipes.
Oh, we just lost all our female viewers.
And it was weird that was what they accepted, you know. So there's all of that in there. Even, you know, Quilla June is kind of trying to rebel against them, but doesn't succeed in more than one way sort of thing. But, yeah, Road Warrior is one of the biggest keys.
You put Road Warrior. I said Mad Max, but yeah.
Yeah, Mad Max.
I mean, if it inspired him to do Mad Max, Mad Max was released in 79, 4 years later. So if he saw this, he made Mad Max 3 years later, probably.
Yep.
And I don't think he just went out and filmed on weekends. But
well, and one of the more recent keys would be Fallout. Okay. Fallout, the creators of the game Fallout, which has now got, I think, 5 iterations in it, say that they were very influenced by this movie, down to the way the cans are the only source of food kind of thing and all of that. And having wild, bizarre little outcroppings of humanity in weird ways, like an outpost, i.e. the committee down under sort of deal.
Yeah, I don't know anything about that game, but I did read that it was heavily inspired by this movie. Yeah,
I've only played up to 4. So I haven't played the last one yet, but I mean, it's really the world building in each game is really incredible. Mm-hmm. It's really cool. Basically, you play a character who was in a Fallout shelter, and it's how you wake up and go out and what you find in the world that's left over. So from a post-apocalyptic standpoint, you'd love it. You'd love some of the stuff.
Cool. Zombies. I need zombies.
There are more like flesh eaters or, you know, cannibals kind of thing. Yeah. I have an influence on this, of course, which is William Shakespeare, because Once More Into the Breach is a quote from Shakespeare.
Is it Henry V?
So,
yeah. I thought it was. I have one that it kind of surprised me because I didn't expect it. Like you said, I had forgotten. But when what's-his-face, that actor that you mentioned, turned into the robot on the stalking
Michael.
Yeah. Yes, Michael. It was very Westworld. I mean, I was like, oh, my God, he's Yul Brynner, man. He is he's just walking up to people and ripping their heads off or shooting.
That's a good one. Yeah.
And I wasn't
expecting that. He should have pulled his face off and he would have been a $6 million man. Yeah.
And Westworld was only a year or two prior to this, probably.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You had said Planet of the Apes. I also have Beneath the Planet of the Apes. Because that movie...
Because they go underground.
Well, they specifically had, the entire weird cultish civilization is living underground in that.
They're just not nuclear babies or whatever. Yeah.
I did have in trivia that this was actually filmed at an Air Force base nuclear silo sort of place.
Hence the bad lighting.
Just in the transition when Vic first climbs down and they're going and he's going down to the below area. And the reason for it was they only had 2 hours to film there because it had just been used by Ice Station Zebra, the movie. Oh. And they had left it so trash that the Navy, the Air Force didn't want to use any other film crews and wanted to let him use it. But LQ essentially, used all of his muscle, beg, borrow, whatever, and got at least 2 hours to do that transition down into the below, which I thought was an interesting little trivia bit.
You totally distracted me with Ice Station Zebra.
Love that movie.
I was like, I need to revisit that. I can't even hardly remember it.
That's where I learned the word dosvidonya, which is until we meet again because of all this. That's a great novel.
Dude. And Rock Hudson never got a lot of cred for acting, but there was like a handful of films he did that he is really well known for, and that's one of them.
He's awesome in that. He's great in it. The guy, Patrick McGowan, is in that. Ernest Borgnine is actually good.
We have a movie on our list that is a Rock Hudson movie called Seconds, and I haven't seen it in a long time, but he thought it was going to be his comeback, and it's a science fiction story.
I have never seen it.
It's John Frankenhammer. Interesting.
Really? Mm-hmm. Okay. I may have to
I think it's on our list. We could definitely do it in one season. So.
Definitely.
Keys. Well, we mentioned Screamers and Star Wars.
Yep.
I have one that I lifted from IMDb, and that's Ray Manzarek, the keyboardist for The Doors, was a musician on this movie.
Yeah. Do you remember the music from this movie?
Not really.
No, not at all. Not at all. not one theme to it.
Well, so why are they crediting him? There must be music somewhere. I don't know.
It must be, but maybe the porno soundtrack.
Well, when I hear The Doors, I think of keyboards, and that's Ray Manzarek.
Yeah.
There's got to be some keyboards in there somewhere.
I'm sure there are. I just I was specifically trying to listen for them and got
that's
nothing.
Hilarious because I had forgotten about it and never heard them. Interesting.
I have just a few left. I have one that's a weird one, which is Alien, but weird in the fact that I've got in my quotes. Michael's a goddamn robot. Because it is like a reveal.
Is that your fat Kano that says that Ash is a goddamn robot?
Ash is a goddamn robot.
Okay, that's a great key because it is kind of funny.
I thought that one was good. I also have kind of a weird one too. This is like in my notes. This is Harlan Ellison's version of Old Yeller.
It is. Oh, wow. That's a great – oh, I like that. I like that a lot.
Because it really is. It's that kind of boy, sacrificing everything for his dog.
But instead, Travis doesn't shoot Old Yeller. He turns around and shoots his mother.
He shoots his mother.
There's no hope for him now, Travis.
Shut up, Mom.
Shut up, Mom.
Yeller and I are going off together. Also, for those of us who, for those of us that are huge Star Trek fans, if you listen again in that one sequence when it's really industrial and he's climbing down the gangways and the stairs and we're seeing all the electronics and everything that's keeping the underground still powered and alive, all of the sound effects in there are from Star Trek. They are all original series Star Trek sound effects.
They ripped them off? Yep. Wow. Yep. I did not know that.
Some of the button cues are there. Some of the overall like ramping up power sounds. A lot of the sound effects.
I guess I should have paid more attention. I've got one more that I actually sent to you.
Oh, that's the same one. Okay. I
have. Yeah. I had read it on IMDb, so I said, "Well, I've got to watch this to see what they're talking about." And apparently, you know, Clockwork Orange came out like 4 years prior. And had a very distinctive trailer. And the trailer to A Boy and His Dog completely rips that off. Yep. And if you watch them side by side, you'll see what I'm talking about. So I sent David both the trailers to say, I said, hey, look at this. Now look at this. It was like, wow. So they were trying.
I saw that too, that they were definitely did it. In homage, so to speak, are influenced by Clockwork.
Yeah, I mean, LQ was striving for Kubrick, but he ended up more of a Frank Henenlotter.
More of a Frank Henenlotter, very well said.
Well, I was going to say this earlier, and I didn't say it, but I kind of equate this movie to Basket Case. The difference, they're both low budget. Basket Case looks like it's filmed in a motel over several weekends. The difference in this movie is I actually feel more empathy for Dwayne and Belial than I do for Vic and Blood. And I don't know if it's because I'm a horror movie fan or if because they're better actors. So I hate to tell you, Don Johnson, but I'm comparing you to Dwayne from Basket Case.
I mean, I think he did a great job in this movie, but I do think he was hampered by, especially by today's mores in the fact that he's not a very likable character, whereas the guy from Basket Case is. Mm-hmm. He's forced to do bad stuff, but so is Seymour from, you know, Little Shop of Horrors. And so we feel a kinship to them that we don't feel for Vic, because Vic is literally just a scavenger and a rogue.
That's always talking about getting laid and raping women, and that's not very likable.
Yeah, not usually. No,
not at all. But I, you know, and I'm going to go ahead and leave it in there as a key. Basket Case is a really good key because his sidekick, Vic, the equivalent, the sidekick Belial in Basket Case is funny. I mean, he makes me laugh. He's not intelligent. He just grunts and makes weird noises and throws things around, but he makes me laugh the same way Vic makes people laugh in this movie.
Well, and they do have that kind of semi-parasitic relationship with each other, that kind of symbiosis. One has to is helping the other.
Yeah, because Belial really can't get around because he's deformed, and Vic can't feed himself. In the desert.
I never ever thought we would parallel A Boy and His Dog and Basket Case.
I kid you not. But this is what was going through my head in the shower this morning. I swear to God.
I could see that. I could see that. Yeah.
Well, so I guess that's going to do us if you don't have anything else. Basket Case versus A Boy and His Dog. We would like to welcome you to our sheer insanity. And this is what I usually try to convince you of in the beginning intros. This kind of weird logic. If you're watching us on YouTube today, we would love for you to subscribe. There's a button down there to the right. I believe it helps us tremendously. It doesn't cost you a nickel. If you listen to us on the podcast airwaves, we appreciate it. If you would like, rate, and review us. If you can't get enough of us, and who can? I mean, really, you need to go over to Patreon. We have some free stuff there as well as some subscriber content and two other shows that we do, one on the X-Files and one on Star Trek, the original series. And until next week, when I think we'll be back in horror land, we will definitely be in October. I'll be seeing you, Mr. Horton.
You sure you had enough to eat?
Oh, yeah. I'm satiated.
What?
Nothing. I said I'm full, but after we walk all day, you'll probably have to
She said she loved me. Well, it wasn't my fault she picked me to get all wet brain over.
Well, I'd say she certainly had marvelous judgment, Albert, if not particularly good taste. Particularly good taste.
Ha 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 ha